Yeah, so Liberty City is the neighborhood in Miami where myself and Terrell grew up. It's kind of like the Compton or South Central of LA. It's sort of the same neighborhood in Miami. And it's interesting because I don't talk about being from there a lot. And so not a lot of people knew that aspect of my biography. And Terrell McCraney, who's a MacArthur genius playwright, he grew up in the same place. And so when he was graduating from DePaul undergrad in 2003 as an acting fellow, he was applying to the Yale School of Drama as a playwright. And he had to do a writing sample or a work sample. And so he wrote this play in Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. And 10 years later, it landed on my doorstep, I like to say, in my inbox, I guess, since it's 2013. And it was really beautiful because when it came to me, the line was, this isn't about you, but it's about you. And what my friends meant, these two guys in Miami who knew both myself and Terrell, was that they knew about this aspect of my biography where my mom was addicted to crack cocaine. And I don't talk about that very much. And here's Terrell McCraney, MacArthur playwright. His mom was addicted to crack cocaine. And so these guys thought, well, we should get these two guys together and have them make a film about that. And that was how it came to me.
Oscar nominee Barry Jenkins speaking to the Academy at the Samuel Goldwyn Theater in Los Angeles. His sensational new film, Moonlight, is one of the finest achievements you're ever likely to see. We'll take a seat in the front row today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead, Xavier Dolan's Grand Prix winner divided audiences at Cannes. Was it really worth the upset?
Of course, the reaction of people is everything. It will always affect me. It doesn't affect my vision of the film.
We'll hear more from the filmmaker extraordinaire as It's Only the End of the World hits UK theatres. And a little later...
You want to kill me? You want to kill Delaina Marcus?
Step aside, Fellini. We'll take an up-close look at the world of Dario Argento, an Italian master of the screen with an entirely different palette. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
One day I was outside trying to learn how to ride my bike. I had just taken off the training wheels and by myself, I kicked them off. I wanted to learn how to ride. And I was failing pretty badly.
Terrell Alvin McCraney wrote his original play, In the Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue, following the death of his mother. But the piece was set aside for nearly a decade and never made it to the stage. Hello from London and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. While McCraney's play might not have been staged, it has indeed finally been brought to glorious life by the director Barry Jenkins. Speaking at the Toronto Film Festival in September, McCraney recalled one of the moments that inspired the original piece.
It was actually the first over there on 16th and 62nd, 63rd Street, where the first scene of this happens and or was shot. And I was trying to get my bike and trying to get it, and I couldn't, and I was falling. And this drug dealer walked out of his, got off his crate, and came and was like, get back on the bike. And he ran with me down the street, pretending to stand behind me until I learned how to ride a bike. And I never forgot that.
Barry Jenkins' film adaptation of McCraney's work, Moonlight, radiates with the presence of its setting. Jenkins and McCraney grew up in the same area of Miami, the inland neighborhood of Liberty City, but the ocean was always close to the heart of McCraney's childhood. Lapping waves are the first sound heard as the film opens. As McCraney told the Miami Herald, he was always drawn to the ocean like a homing device. It's vast, but it lets you know where you are, who you are within the world. It tells you that you are part of the world in a way, even if everything else is telling you that you're not. Moonlight will undoubtedly come to be known as that gay black movie, but it's also a tragically short description of a story that's utterly original.
And so all of my life I have been, had these snatches, this patchwork of generosity lended to me from unlikely people and in some pretty ungenerous circumstances. It just became important to me to put those together and try to tell that story as best I could.
With McCraney's story as his canvas, Barry Jenkins has crafted a most stunning reason to visit the movies. After the diversity debate that erupted in the face of last year's Oscars, it might be tempting to see Moonlight as the natural response, a token gesture to allay fears of reprisal. That too would be a mistake, because Moonlight isn't just about being black, and it isn't just about being gay either. And yet, nor does it treat those issues as inconsequential. They're vital parts of the central character's identity, known in three parts of the film as Little, Chiron, and finally, Black.
What you see before you is actually me trying to figure out how to tell that story, and then Barry seeing it and going, oh, I have the language, I have the tools, I have the know-how to make these people stand up.
Jenkins' brave ability to stand back allows the characters and their surroundings to tell the story and communicate the emotions being felt. What could have easily fallen into the realm of mumblecore is instead rendered as something entirely unique. For both the playwright and the filmmaker, this was a deeply personal project. While they inhabited the same neighborhood in their younger years and their lives share remarkable similarities, their paths had actually never crossed. But it was those similarities in detail that helped convince Barry that, despite being straight, he was a strong enough storyteller to bring this material to life.
And so right away, I just saw this place where, you know, I've always considered myself an ally for people who identify as LGBTQ, and yet I never thought I could write a character that had that as a foundational element of their identity, where there was so much that just sort of like blended between our biographies that I thought this is, you know, I want to step up to this challenge. And as an ally, I don't want to be a passive ally, I want to be an active ally. And so I took the play and I began adapting it.
The true genius of cinema is when it allows us to transcend our own consciousness and experience life from the perspective of someone else. Moonlight offers this gift in a way that very few films can. From a bullied childhood through the struggle of his early adult years, Chiron's life could be seen as the summation of a gay man born into a poor, rough neighborhood to a drug-addicted mother. But he's so much more than his circumstances and his experiences. He's human, he's just like you, and yet he's also not. Suggesting this is a universal story would be to diminish its individuality and source of origin. And yet, like Jenkins and McCraney, to step inside the soul of this character is to find common ground. Moonlight is out in cinemas now. Now, you might recall an interview that we featured a few months ago with the filmmaker Xavier Dolan. Despite winning the Grand Prix prize at Cannes last year, his film, It's Only the End of the World, attracted some fairly sharp critique. But don't believe everything you hear.
L'ancienne maison?
Oui. Quoi?
Bah, ils vont voir l'ancienne maison.
Bah.
Moi, ça me dérange pas, je veux bien me conduire si tu veux.
Mais pourquoi tu veux te retrouver là-bas? T'es bête ou quoi?
From its opening frame, It's Only the End of the World presents us with a young man in the final stretch of his life. Louis is on his way back to his family home to announce that he's dying. This is a bleak film, but not in the shade of, say, ordinary people. There are far too few moments for Louis to gather his thoughts amongst all the screaming and mindless antagonism. Nor is it familial mining of the truth in the mould of, say, August Osage County. Dolan famously doesn't watch many films, which might explain why this, like so many of his films, doesn't seem to follow the rules of what we might expect of a film's plot structure. This illustration of a family permeates with pessimism, resentment, and deep frustration. Louis's brother Antoine, played by Vincent Cassel, spends his days in a workshop making tools. He's a volcano of anger whose only grasp is on the practical and the tactical, and he's ready to spit lava at any notion that his brother's chosen career as a writer is anything other than stupid. His younger sister only vaguely remembers Louis as her brother, while his mother, despite instinctive compassion, can barely conceal her confused sense of abandonment. Much of the film seems to be resting on the very edge of something being said, but ultimately, it's a tale of dysfunction. A brutal, fiery depiction of what happens when communication disintegrates and the family dynamic fails.
Comment le ton a malmené, modifié, je sais pas. T'as pas un plan plus à la mort moelleux pour les faire en famille comme ça tous ensemble là?
Despite a prickly reception from some at Cannes last year, the film won the Grand Prix prize. And Dolan told me that of all the films he's made so far, this one satisfies him the most.
I mean, emotionally, I'm prouder of certain things for different reasons, but as a whole, an ensemble, when I look at It's Only the End of the World, it seems to me, at least, that it's the one that's most complete in terms of storytelling, in terms of everything.
Many filmmakers treat themselves as their primary audience, and while that may be true for Dolan, he's also a young filmmaker with a sensitive soul.
I just think that what matters in making movies is that the movie you are watching is all the elements are working and walking at once in synchronicity. All the elements are aligned and none are peaking or standing out in a distracting way. The acting of one or the music here or the effects there or the sets or the costumes or whichever effect of camera or motion is not distracting from the story. So this is why It's Only the End of the World is my favorite one. And of course, the reaction of people is everything. It will always affect me. It doesn't affect my vision of the film and what I think of the film, but it does affect me. It does, you know, if it's negative or aggressive or cruel or crude. Of course, I'm a human being. I can't evolve in this world if I am not sensitive to what people say about my work.
Non, commence pas à me faire porter le chapeau, hein. Si t'as envie de t'exprimer, tu t'exprimes, parle. Ne veux pas porter comme si je te brimais, que je t'empêchais de parler, ça va?
Some critics walked away from the film scratching their heads at the lack of clear resolution. After culminating in an epic shouting match filled with bursts of long repressed anger and unresolved family tension, the film quite suddenly pivots away from what we might expect. But as Dolan explains, this was never going to be a story of family resolve. Sometimes that's just not how things work out.
I know that people were frustrated to not know why the lead character had actually gone, why he had left home years ago without ever coming back. I know they are frustrated that I never said whether he was dying of AIDS or cancer or what it was exactly he was dying from. Does it really matter? I think that what matters is what these people have to say to one another in within that given amount of time, the time that they have together, which is, what, 5 or 6 hours tops. So that's what the film is about. How you use the time you have with the people that are in front of you and how you come clean with them, how you try to be true to yourself, but without ever finding the right words, and because you are uncomfortable in your skin and you are nervous and insecure and everything you say is actually bullshit, and all you're trying to say is I love you, but you are too proud to say that. There will be no white flag above my door. I'm in
love and always will be. That was Xavier Dolan. Few filmmakers divide audiences quite as effectively, but then again, few manage to attract quite so much attention either. Dolan is even pictured inside the first few pages of Monocle's latest issue of our magazine as the face of Louis Vuitton. It's Only the End of the World is screening in the UK, Ireland and Greece right now. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, and of course, it's Oscar weekend. And what a lineup of films. But if you've somehow managed to make your way all the way through the awards contenders, well, MUBI has a retrospective happening just for you.
And the winner is... Italy for investigation of a citizen above suspicion.
The award for Best Foreign Language Film at the 1971 Oscars went to Italy for Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion. The psychological tale of corruption by director Elio Petri was a sensation upon its release, with the music by the legend Ennio Morricone also attracting praise.
Elio Petri can't be with us tonight. He's preparing a new film, but I'm sure he would want me to say how grateful and thrilled he is.
Actress Leslie Caron accepted the Oscar. Vincent Canby wrote in the New York Times that although Mr. Petri quite consciously makes movies about ideas, he has in this made a movie in which the ideas and the man who seethes with them have the shock and impact of the most fundamental kind of melodrama.
Three eggs over easy, two sausage, six strips of bacon with fries.
Fries today.
A short stack. Coffee with cream and sweetener.
Now, has it been long enough for us to call 1997's As Good As It Gets a classic? Well, I'll let you decide, but in any case, it's definitely one of those films worth revisiting time and time again. This story of an obsessive-compulsive novelist played by Jack Nicholson and a single mother of a sick son played by Helen Hunt was nominated for Best Picture and took the statues for actor and actress as well. Both films are screening right now on Mubi, the curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning cinema, alongside a tantalizing list of other awards favorites too. Head over to mubi.com/monocle for a whole month of movies for free. That's MUBI/monocle. This is the Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Now, of all the countries that have competed for the Best Foreign Language Oscar, Italy remains the reigning champion with a record 14 wins. But if you're already picturing Anita Ekberg dancing in a fountain, well, sit back for a moment while I enter your dreams and rearrange some of the furniture.
It doesn't.
Oh, hello.
Ma scherzi?
No, non credere che voglia risparmiarmi il disagio.
When we talk about Italian cinema, it's often the tales of classic neorealism that spring to mind. Films by the great talents such as Luchino Visconti, Vittorio De Sica, and Roberto Rossellini. We all know the tales of the streets, the vices and the virtues, the dreams and the neuroses of Rome by Federico Fellini, the spaghetti westerns by Sergio Leone. Italian cinema has shown us how they live, how they love, how they seduce their women, or at least how they'd like to, and even how they shoot. But what about their dreams? Less often have we been given a glimpse into how a classical Italian nightmare might be seen through the eyes of a cinematic auteur. Britain had its Hammer films. German film history is scattered with the influence of its brilliant expressionism. From around the 60s and the 70s, Italian cinema began developing the theme of fear with a whole new light. Directors like Mario Bava and Lucio Fulci, to name but a few, became some of the most important artists as a new cinematic movement was born, Giallo all'Italiana. The genre was well established when, at the cusp of the 1970s, a young Roman made his directorial debut with The Bird with the Crystal Plumage, or L'Uccello dalle Piume di Cristallo. As impressive an entrance it might have been, it was a mere seed in what would become a jungle of classics throughout the 70s and beyond. Contaminating horror with melodrama, the work of Dario Argento is at its best when his films ripple with an impulse that forces the eye to watch at all costs. Long waits, music that suggests a psychedelic nightmare, and the chromatic scale pushed to the extreme. All of this set off by a kaleidoscope of lush colours. It all pushes Argento's work during his prime into a realm all of its own. Many of his best-loved works throw doubt onto the expectations of what we might call a story. Like A Lucid Dream with hints of psychoanalysis, Argento dismisses the questions of what's credible when it comes to the art of creation. The Argento narrative often wanders away from the traditional arc of a character in favor of something beautiful for the audiences to look at, even if it's beauty found in the horror of a murder scene. Argento directed his most mature work with 1975's Deep Red, or Profondo Rosso. The soundtrack, directed by the Italian progressive rock band Goblin, will remain forever in the collective imagination as one of the most perfect and disturbing symphonies ever written for film. I recall a conversation I once had with a friend about Argento's work, which, as often as it has been before, eventually took the form of a debate in which I assumed the position of auteur's defense. Try to look at a Dario Argento movie without the sound, my friend dared me. Would you still find it scary? I assumed my friend had not seen Suspiria, Argento's second collaboration with the Goblins, and his first attempt at a supernatural horror.
Who is it? Who's there? I've been expecting you. The American girl. I knew you'd come.
It's a fairy tale nightmare of Art Deco, a deep, dark cauldron of the witches of Macbeth, and it's the best known and best loved of Argento's films. And yet, Suspiria is still seen today as a totally experimental film. With terrific cinematography by Luciano Tavoli, the film's music explodes with lush layers that blend modern with classic, human whispers and magical rites. While critics praised Argento as Italy's new Hitchcock, his work took on an eternal life of its own internationally. Today, his work is often more appreciated at retrospectives outside of Italy than by the director's own contemporaries.
The Wizard of Gore?
That is Herschel Gordon Lewis. He's the ultimate master of horror.
Please! Dario Argento is so the ultimate master of horror.
Argento? He's all right. But Lewis is completely demented. Okay, we're talking about buckets of goo. I mean, there's red corn syrup all over the place. There's fake brains.
Among those who benefited from a spot under Argento's wing are Michele Suavi and Lamberto Bava, son of Mario Bava, of whom Argento himself was a faithful pupil. Not to mention the countless filmmakers who've been influenced by his idiosyncratic style, notably Nicholas Winding Refn, whose recent film, The Neon Demon, flaunted a palette of colors that would make Argento proud.
Before Dario comes on stage, I think that there is something we should celebrate in Dario Argento, in that he's one of the greatest Italian filmmakers of all time, hands down. And I know what I'm talking about. I create stars, and Dario Argento, I seriously believe, is one of the most influential filmmakers of all time, and he's from Italy, so you should be very proud of that.
Like a zombie that just won't stay dead, the film festivals of Argento's work will forever be lighting up cinema screens around the world. In Italy, meanwhile, the young director, Luca Guadagnino, has his hands on the reins of a remake of Suspiria. Even if Argento's greatest gifts are in decades past, through an endless circle of watching and rewatching, this auteur's nightmarish hallucinations somehow keep finding new life. That was Argento's Dream Factory, an original essay written by the Italian film journalist Stefano Notaro. Movie subscribers in the United States can catch both Demons and Demons 2, directed by Lamberto Bava and produced by Dario Argento.
Hit me! When the four corners of this cocoon collide, you'll slip through the cracks, hoping that you'll survive.
That brings us to the end of today's program. Next week, we're jumping into a pool of cinematic cool with a carefully curated list of films that evoke a strange, inimitable sense of freshness, starting with 1958's Murder by Contract, which was famously cited by Martin Scorsese as the film that has influenced him most. Today's show was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Now don't forget to subscribe to the podcast of this program wherever you happen to get your audio. And we'll leave you now with a track that helped inspire a scene at the very beginning of Moonlight the origins of which lie in an obscure blaxploitation film. The first time that Barry Jenkins heard it was in this track by Kendrick Lamar, Wesley's Theory. The Cinema Show is back next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thank you for listening. Few M16s to the hood, pass them all out on a black one's good. I'ma put the cop to